Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, it's one of those true life stories that makes you ask yourself, what would I have done in that time, in that setting? The book is The Saboteur, the aristocrat who became France's most daring anti-Nazi commando. And it's the story of a largely unsung hero of the French resistance during World War II. The hero at the heart of this story, Robert de la Rochefoucauld. He was a French aristocrat who turned undercover anti-Nazi leader. My guest this hour is the author of the book I just named, Paul Kix, deputy editor at ESPN, the magazine. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, GQ, Men's Journal, Wall Street Journal, other places as well. He's a native Iowan. He grew up in Hubbard, just north of Ames. He's a graduate of Iowa State University's Greenlee School of Journalism and Communication and joins me this hour. Paul Kix, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
I want to mention, too, that you're speaking tonight at ISU. The title of your talk, Talk is Cheap, Free Speech Isn't, Why the First Amendment is Worth It. That's at 8 p.m. on ISU's campus this evening. Start us off by telling us about the family that this man came from, the aristocratic family. And it's really interesting here because in the U.S., we really don't have an equivalent. So explain this family, what it meant in French culture in which this man grew up.
So the best way to try to do that is to first by comparing it to the, because there isn't really an American comparison. What I always like to say is, if you imagine that the Kennedys or the Bushes had been in power for roughly 1,000 years, that would equal the power that the La Rochefoucaulds have enjoyed. They are synonymous with wealth, with prestige. There's a street named after them in Paris. Marcel Proust in Search of Lost Time, he references the La Rochefoucauld family repeatedly. And perhaps my favorite story, to give you a sense of who exactly they were. 1789, Louis XVI is looking down on the Garden of Versailles, and he sees the pitchforks is coming. And he turns to an aide, and he goes, "Is this a revolt?" And the aide says, "No, sire, this is the revolution." And it was a revolution, and that aide was Robert's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather.
Amazing. Amazing. But also, yeah, for hundreds of years, this name has made itself felt in French history. The father of Robert de la Rochefoucauld, Foucault, was an officer in the First World War, you point out in the book. His mother, a countess.
Yes, exactly, yeah. So he had this sense when he was growing up that he had to try to find a way to write his own chapter in the family history.
Mm-hmm. We want to get to the occupation. I think that's a fascinating part of your book, but tell us about before the occupation of France, how Robert met Hitler by chance in 1938. And this is when Hitler has been the chancellor of Germany for several years, and we're just about to kick into the Second World War, right?
Yes, exactly. So because of his station in life, Robert is educated at the finest boarding schools in Europe, and one of them is outside Salzburg. It is a Marist boarding school, and one day the priest takes the boys on a hike, and he actually takes them to Hitler's Alpine retreat, Berchtesgaden, and the boys all take this in, this compound and this villa surrounding it. And then there's these line of Mercedes that wend their way down this long driveway. And the boys step back from the road, and then the line of Mercedes stop. And out of one of those cars is Adolf Hitler himself. And the boys are just, they're flummoxed. They had no idea. And everybody's really deferential. Robert himself, he had been learning German, and he tried out some German. And Hitler apparently just smiled and said something like Franzosen, which means the French one, because his accent was apparently terrible. And then he patted him on the head and then went back on his way. So Robert admitted in his memoir that at the time he didn't really understand the context of current affairs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fast forward a couple years after that. Take us to 1940-ish. Nazi Germany overruns France, as it does with Western Europe, very quickly with their Blitzkrieg. Set the scene for us. I, in particular, I was so surprised, and I wonder if in doing the research too, about this book, you were too, that you brought out some of the real nuances of an occupation. One of the quotes I have here from your book, "It was no easy task to hate your neighbor all the time, even when they overrun your country," right?
Yes. I'm glad you bring that up, Ben, because I actually wanted the occupation to be its own character in the book. Researching it, I became just so deeply fascinated by the complexities of the occupation in Europe, and in particular the occupation in France, and what that meant when you are confronted on a day-to-day basis with Germans. And eventually, the German officers, even the Nazi Gestapo agents, end up becoming a sort of passé part of the scenery. And I wanted to explore a little bit what that does to a collective psyche and an individual psyche.
Mm-hmm. Because it's very important, because you juxtapose the people who, well, you have the collaborators, but you have the people who didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Right.
And scholars would later contend they made up the vast majority of the French populace. Perhaps as much as 70% of the population were apathetic, mm-hmm, and did nothing during the war.
I was surprised that you point out most French got along with the Germans that had invaded their land, even respected them, even made comparisons between of Hitler to Napoleon.
Yeah, it was really amazing. Of the openly fascist collaborative newspapers, one was called Je suis partout, or I am everywhere, and that newspaper kind of likened Hitler to some sort of pan-European king, in a sense, as somebody who would shape Europe to the way it was supposed to be shaped. And a lot of the response to that, a lot of the reason that people were saying that was because there were large swaths of the French populace on either the conservative or liberal end of the political spectrum who just felt that they were tired of the Third Republic. It was sort of rotting, and the government wasn't as well run as it should have been. And so they looked to Hitler actually as some sort of, again, like some sort of enabler for a better time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so France is overrun in 1940 in a matter of weeks, and we've had this covered in such films as Dunkirk, also Darkest Hour as of recent times, and Hollywood films. France is divided into two. It's occupied. The north, occupied by Nazi Germany, and then the Vichy. Describe a little bit of why that was done, as you do in your book.
So I think I'm not the only one who thinks this. There are, again, a lot of scholars who've said that might have been one of Hitler's most brilliant moves, to divide the country in two and give the southern half over to a quasi-French government, where the rules would be a little bit looser, you wouldn't see as many, you know, openly fascist memorabilia. Basically, fascism wouldn't take as hold as strong in the South as it did in the North.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is really because Hitler wanted to try to placate the French government so that it would not try to, you know, move into Africa. French government officials would move into Africa, and especially the French colonies that France still occupied, or still, you know, it was colonialism basically still of the 20th century. And the thinking there was, well, if we can keep them from going to, say, Algeria, then that means that they'll stay in France. And if they stay in France, then we can actually try, if we're the Germans, we can actually try to move up from Italy. So it was seen as somewhat of a brilliant military and political move at the time. Of course, it would take on much darker tones as the war moved on, and all of France was ultimately occupied in 1942. And then the really sort of... France was known as the French look at that occupation today as the Dark Years, and from 1941 on, that's when the dark years really earned their name.
My guest this hour is the author of the book, The Saboteur. It's received so many great reviews. The Saboteur, the aristocrat who became France's most daring anti-Nazi commando. Paul Kix is the author of the book, deputy editor at ESPN, the magazine. He's a native Iowan, also a graduate of Iowa State University. Okay, so here we get into the real personal part of this story, how your character, the true life character, Robert de la Rochefoucauld, experienced the occupation. I wonder if I could ask you to read from your book, because when the Germans attack, overrun France, he is just a 16-year-old, and France surrenders to Nazi Germany, right?
Yeah, he is 16 at the outbreak of the war in 1939, and by the time that the Germans have defeated the French, he is, I think, 17. So he's still very, very young.
Okay, read from the part. If you can, you write so well about how he experienced the occupation and how he is motivated to, whatever comes, resist the Nazis.
Yeah, so... In his travels around Paris or on frequent stops home, he grew genuinely angry at his defeated countrymen. He felt cheated. His life, his limitless young life, was suddenly defined by terms he did not set and did not approve of. What galled him was that few people seemed to think as he did. He found that a lot of people in Paris and in Soissons were relieved the war was over, even if it meant the country was no longer theirs. The pre-war pacifism had gelled into a post-war defeatism. Fractured France was experiencing an intellectual and moral anesthesia, in the words of one prefect. It was bizarre. Robert had the sense that the ubiquitous German soldiers who hopped onto the metro or sipped coffee in a cafe were already part of a passé scenery for the natives.
Hmm. Paul Kix, reading from his book, The Saboteur. So what did he do then? He listened to the radio, which our listeners are doing right now. He listened to Charles de Gaulle, who was in London at this time, right?
Yeah, he's in London. So de Gaulle is the only general to not admit defeat after the battle for France was lost. And what he did was he escaped to London and began working with the BBC to broadcast a nightly message that basically argued that the French should fight on. And he established something called the Free French Forces, which initially just consisted of himself and one other officer, but would ultimately go on to be a battle force that would align themselves with the Allied forces and see the theaters of war in the Pacific and, of course, in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the founding of the organization that Robert eventually joined. How did he join it? This is it goes by the acronym SOE, Special Operations Executive.
Yes. So Robert was very taken by what de Gaulle was saying, and he thought, if I can get to London, I can join the Free French. So the only way to get to London was actually to go south through Spain, because you couldn't just cross the channel. The Germans had occupied it, and it was very heavily manned. So he goes south through the Pyrenees, and he ends up making his way to England. But as he gets to England, he is, in the words of intelligence agencies throughout the world, intercepted. And he is intercepted by this group called Special Operations Executive. It was a new branch of British intelligence services, and its main job was to, quote, foment anarchy by any means, anywhere. And Winston Churchill loved it. He said that it should set Europe ablaze.
And it was a first of its kind, right?
It was the first of its kind. There had never been an intelligence agency really in the world like it, because its main job was to train people who could get to London from other countries in occupied Europe, train them in all sorts of tactics, legal and illegal. In fact, it was known as the Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. And once these resistance fighters had obtained this sort of training, they would then parachute back into their native countries, at which point it would be, again, anarchy by any means. And Churchill loved it. He said, let's set Europe ablaze now. Mm-hmm. And it was incredibly successful. So I detail in the book some of the missions that, in some sense, really turned the whole war that were SOE missions.
Right. And talk a little bit about the training. Well, first of all, Robert did, in fact, meet this figure, Charles de Gaulle.
Yes.
It was sort of anticlimactic, as I experienced your reading.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think in large part because of his name and again, the prestige of the La Rochefoucauld family, he's able to actually get a meeting with de Gaulle, where the only thing he wants to ask him is, look, I'm really sort of intrigued by this idea of joining this British outfit. What do you think? And de Gaulle had a very complicated relationship with the Brits. And he said, basically, even if it's allied with the devil, go. It's for France.
Right. It's against the Nazis.
It's against the Nazis. But the devil in Great Britain
right.
is the devil you have to fight alongside.
Okay, so let's get into his training, the SOE training. You describe it in your book. It's really quite interesting. I don't know if you have another passage there that you could share with us that gives us a sense of this unique, first of its kind, operation, the type of training they received, and also then we understand how it would inspire sort of Ian Fleming to create James Bond and inspire our own CIA, for instance. Tell us about the training.
It was psychological. It was engineering. It was learning how to sabotage any sort of industrial facility and learning how to do it with only a few pounds of explosives. So you had to figure out where were the key components in the layout of any building, and how you can best set those explosives against those key components. Then, of course, there were the very brutal tactics that men learned how to break thumbs, break backs. They learned the best way to kick someone in the testicles, the best way to gouge out a man's eyes. They learned something called silent killing, which it pretty much describes itself. They also learned how to break locks. They were actually trained by criminals into how to do, you know, sort of petty thievery, how to get away with picking wallets. They learned how to endure psychological interrogations and torture. There was a novelist who also became an SOE agent. And he said, an average man of average height and average weight could go into any situation armed with a certain sort of knowledge. And with that knowledge came a set of confidence that you could overcome any situation you were faced with, that any opening, any battle presented certain ways for you to win that battle. And that was only because of all the training they received in London. And where they were going back to, this is perhaps important to point out, they would need every bit of that confidence because the resistance fighters the Germans found, they killed.
Right, and in quite gruesome ways often.
Terrible ways.
And that was preceded often by torture to get information about other agents they were working with. Let's talk about the initial, after the training, Robert de la Rochefoucauld is parachuted into France, into his native land, with all of this training. And this is early on in the resistance. They're quite successful, right?
Yeah, so his mission is pretty successful. He's parachuted into a rural department in France called the Yonne Department. And his initial mission is sort of threefold. Number one, there were some industrial facilities he was asked to sabotage. Number two, he was supposed to build up the resistance networks in that rural department. And number three, he was supposed to provide as many arms and guns and everything else as he could. So he helped organize plane drops in the middle of the night so the men could receive more arms. He helped build up this roster of resistance fighters. He was often leading men who were twice his age. By this point, Robert, in the summer of 1943, would have been 19. And a lot of the, again, a lot of the men were either, it was interesting, it was either like 19, 20-year-olds, or it was actually the generation that's a little bit older than that. It was 40 and 45-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as initially, it's a very successful mission.
And then at one point, a double agent infiltrates the resistors, who are having quite a bit of success. Describe how that happened, and what were the consequences, the lives that were cost there?
Yeah, so the British actually said that a man in France has about 6 months before the odds begin to work against you. And the odds began to work against this resistance group. It's infiltrated by a double agent by the name of J.P. Lyon, and it's unknown if he flipped under torture or had collaborativist views and just sort of moved that way naturally. But there was a German army intelligence officer named Kurt Merck who flipped him. And Lyon ended up infiltrating one of the largest resistance networks in France. It was known as Noah's Ark because all of the different resistance fighters had code names of animals. And there were hundreds of animals. Like it was something like out of Noah's Ark, right? But 1943 eventually became known as the Terrible Year, according to the leader of Noah's Ark, because of how many resistance fighters were arrested, tortured, and ultimately killed.
And of course, he is captured himself very quickly before we could go to break. Tell us about the he's captured three times by the Nazis. The first capture, how does it happen?
So he's in a rural village of about 1,000 people, and he was living there and sleeping in a barn. And he sees left and right his comrades appearing one day and then never appearing again. So he's wondering if the same fate's going to happen to him. And one night he's jostled awake in the barn, and there's a semicircle of men in leather jackets and felt hats, and it's the Gestapo. Hmm. And they smile at him, and then they beat him.
Okay. We'll leave it there for now. We'll go to a break. Fascinating book. True story. The Saboteur, the aristocrat who became France's most daring anti-Nazi commando. My guest is Paul Kix, Iowa native, ISU graduate, native who grew up in Hubbard, Iowa. Fascinating book. We'll be back in just a moment with the hero at the heart of this story that Paul has been writing about, Robert de la Roche Foucault, and his anti-Nazi work during the Second World War. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour, Paul Kix, deputy editor at ESPN, the magazine. He's a graduate of Iowa State University, a native Iowan, grew up in Hubbard, just north of Ames, and we're talking about his very first book. It's called The Saboteur, The Aristocrat Who Became France's Most Daring Anti-Nazi Commando. It's about the story of Robert de la Roche Foucault, a French aristocrat. He became a resistance leader during the Second World War, escaped three times from the Nazis, and it's such a fascinating story. Let's get back to it. There are so many nuances, so many cliffhangers, Paul, in this book. I know we won't get to all of them, but let's pick up where we left off before the break. He's first captured. How does he get out of that?
Not easily is the answer. He's actually set to be executed. And he spends 4 months in this prison in Auxerre, where if whatever you want to imagine the Nazis doing to someone from whom they wanted to extract information, that's what happened in Auxerre. And the one thing they wanted to know from Robert is, who are you? Who do you work for? And where are more of those guns that we found in the barn? Robert didn't give any information, so he's set for his execution. And because he didn't give any information, the Nazis made one mistake as he's going literally in a truck on the way to his execution. They had failed to handcuff him. And he's sitting in an open-air bed with literally lying on a coffin, sitting on the coffin he will soon fill. And there is a German soldier on either side of him with high-powered rifles in their laps. And he decides that if he's going to die as he'd lived, fighting. And he decides that he's going to make a jump out of the truck. So the first thing he does is he slams his way into one of the soldiers and then rolls out of the truck. The truck is moving probably somewhere around like 40 miles per hour. But again, because of that training he had had in London, he had learned how to roll and somersault out of moving vehicles or moving trains or whatever the case may be. So he gets up and he starts sprinting. And the other soldier immediately opens fire. As that soldier opens fire, the truck's driver sort of is alarmed by the sound, and he slams on the brakes. Well, the truck just slams to a stop, right? So the momentum throws the second guy over the hood. Meanwhile, that first volley of bullets has missed Robert, so now he continues to run down the street. And I mean, really, like, we could talk about just that sequence, Ben, for the next hour, because this thing spans days, this ultimate escape from the Nazis.
Mm-hmm. He eventually rejoins another resistance group, this one in the province of Bordeaux, a well-established one with hundreds of resistors there. Tell us about that story and the work that he did with them.
So first, perhaps the best place to start is actually with the Germans who were in Bordeaux. Bordeaux was a port city, so because it's a port city, it was also a U-boat base going back to 1940. Whatever dangers he faced in central France, and there were many of them, they were compounded by just simply the fact that the Germans knew Bordeaux really well. And there was a resistance fighter who said that Bordeaux is where the finest is a cemetery filled with the finest resistance fighters. So the organization with which he ended up aligning was one that was called Charlie. And it was perhaps, questionably, the equal of the Gestapo agents in terms of the intelligence and counterintelligence that they used, the resistance networks. That network itself also aligned itself with one that was actually run by a special operations executive commando who was of British and French extraction. And so it was a really sort of a feudal civil sort of war between the resistance and the Germans in Bordeaux.
Mm-hmm. And Robert comes into this situation and becomes one of their leaders.
And one of his missions there is even more daring than anything he did in central France. He was asked to sabotage a German munition factory staffed and run by Germans themselves. So what he had to do, at first he thought that, well, maybe if I can just train a worker who's sympathetic to the resistance cause, that can work. But then he realized, no, I'm actually going to go work at the munitions factory itself. And the disguises he had to use, the foresight he had to have in as he mapped the place trying to figure out which part of the munitions factory to bomb. This was key because one of the things that was important here for context, the British had actually dropped literally tons of bombs on this munitions factory, but they were indiscriminate. And within months, the Germans had it operating at full strength. So Robert's mission was to succeed where tons of bombs had not, and to sabotage just the key, again, the key components that we were talking about earlier of a munitions factory. Just hit those and see if you can derail the munitions compound for longer than the British bombs could.
Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating that with 40 pounds of explosives, I think this is smuggled in what loaves of bread over a period of days by him and other resistors who are in the workforce, right?
It's incredibly ingenious what they end up thinking about. You know, it's like, yes, they would cut open loaves of bread and stick the plastic explosives in there. Robert had a false bottom in his shoe, and so he would stick that in, and then he would open up this false bottom in his heel, and he would take out more explosive there and then put them in these sort of safe spots where he thought the Germans patrolling the facility would not look.
Mm-hmm. How much damage ended up being done compared to the bombing that had previously taken out parts of this munitions factory?
So according to two separate British reports, Robert says that he only had somewhere between, as you mentioned a minute ago, 10 and 20 kilograms worth of explosive material. We don't know the actual amount of damage, but what we do know is that the German factory was out of commission for basically 2 weeks longer than what the British bombing campaign had done.
Mm-hmm. And this is important, especially at this time. This comes in what...
This is the summer of 1944, so this is D-Day plus, you know, about 30 or so days.
Okay.
And so everything that can be done right now just to try to win the war is being done.
Perhaps you can talk a little bit about the resistance, the work here done during, coordinated with the D-Day attack, the Allied invasion of the French coast, Normandy, June 6th, 1944. Because I think when we talk about unsung heroes, this is an unsung part of the war. You write that Eisenhower later estimated that the resistance in France after D-Day was the equivalent of 15 extra divisions. That's nearly 400,000 soldiers.
And it's absolutely fascinating because I come into this book with an American understanding of World War II. You know, it's Patton coming down through, and then
right.
we win the battle for France. and to study the resistance in that period, you realize that, my goodness, there was such a coordinated mission. I mean, there were 1,000 sabotages on June 6th alone, and that was not a coincidence.
1,000.
1,000 sabotages.
On one day. D-Day.
On one day. And it's also, and it's coordinated to try to slow the Nazi progression to the beach. And there are stories after stories of these panzer divisions trying to get to the beach to support the Germans, and they can't because their equipment is sabotaged in some way, or the German soldiers themselves, there's sniper attacks coming in from the hills. That's resistance fighters. There's one story of a panzer division that was supposed to get to the beach in 2 days. It took instead 3 weeks.
Mm. If you just joined us, my guest is Paul Kix, deputy editor at ESPN, the magazine. His first book out. It's amazing. A true life story. The saboteur, the aristocrat who became France's most daring anti-Nazi commando, the hero at the heart of this story, true life hero, Robert de la Rochefoucauld, a French aristocrat, grew up, was in his teens when France was overrun and surrendered to Nazi Germany. He turned to become an undercover anti-Nazi leader. Tell us about, I think we've skipped a capture. He was captured 3 times by the Nazis and escaped 3 times. The third capture. So you talked about the munitions plant sabotage at Saint-Mandard.
Yeah.
And after this, he is, tell us a little bit about how he's captured. He's biking in the dark, of course. He doesn't just put a light on his bike like we would do because
no.
he doesn't want to be captured, right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. So after the sabotage of that munitions factory, there are a lot of Gestapo agents who are trying to figure out who exactly was behind it. And so he has to hide out for a few days, and he ends up making his way by night on a bike to try to get to another safe house in Bordeaux, from which he will go, it's exactly unclear where, but basically he has to get out of the area. As he's going along this deserted path, or at least what he thinks is deserted, it turns out that there was a German checkpoint. And the Germans flash their flashlights on him and show their guns very quickly. Now, Robert had a cover story in mind. It was that he was in the woods making love with his girlfriend. But he it sort of caught him off guard, this checkpoint that he wasn't expecting, and he began to stumble more than he should have, and the Germans began to wonder if perhaps he was telling the truth. And so he was thrown in to a prison in Bordeaux called Fort Duha that was manned by a Gestapo agent who is, as it concerns narrative alone, the perfect villain. It was a guy named Friedrich Wilhelm Dosa, and he was one of the smartest men in France.
Mm-hmm. Oh, your description.
And one of the most evil.
Oh, yeah. Your description, just mentioning his name after reading your book makes me shiver. He is really the perfect villain. And this is the point at which Robert weighs his options. He thinks there is really no way out. And you mentioned the secret compartment he has in his shoe. He has a cyanide pill there.
Yes, he does. So SOE agents were given a cyanide pill for basically this very instance when an agent had been captured and began to doubt whether he would be able to endure what was about to happen. Now, what you need to remember is by this point, Robert has already endured 4 months of torture in Auxerre. Mm. And he doesn't know if he can endure more. And he takes out the cyanide pill. It's on a Sunday night, and he knows the reputation of Dosa exceeds the walls of Fort Duha. So he knows that Dosa is going to be coming in on a Monday morning, and the interrogation is going to begin. So he's looking at this cyanide pill in his hand, and he's debating, do I end it right now? And he thinks, I'm going to go out as I've lived, fighting. And so he decides, I'm going to try to literally walk right out of this prison tonight. And he devises a way to do it.
Well, yeah, and that is a whole story in itself. We're running out of time. That is amazing. This is like, I have to tell you, Paul, one of my favorite books as a kid, the first book that I just lost myself in elementary school was Papillon. This is Papillon on steroids.
Well, thank you. I mean, I knew when I started out researching this that I had really good material to work with. And a lot of times as I was writing it, I was just like, stay out of the way of the story and just put it down on the page.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about what went into making this book, because I see that the subject of your book, Robert de la Rochefoucauld, died not too many years ago at the age of 88 on VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. Amazing.
It really is. So I found out about this story reading the New York Times. I was doing nothing more than just flipping through the paper one day, and I came across the obituaries, and one of the obituaries in the paper was about Robert, who had died outside Paris, and that obituary detailed some of his life. And I remember reading this obituary on my phone and being like, wow, that would actually, I was in the process of trying to develop another book, but my progress had kind of stalled. And so I thought, wow, this could actually be a great book. But I didn't speak French at the time. And my wife and I had 3 small kids and there were all these other things. So I thought, I can't do this right now. But as the summer of 2012, when Robert died, became the fall of 2012, this thing kept nagging at me.
Sure.
I felt like I had to do it. And what I like to say is I didn't really choose to write this book so much as it chose me.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine it was all-consuming once you got
Absolutely.
Into it. Okay, but you turned to his family. Were they hard to convince to, I know you interviewed with them, were they open to this completely?
They were a little bit suspicious at first as why exactly an American would want to talk about their father, but once I was able to tell them that, look, I'm just really interested in what happened to your father. And there was this animating question of why. Why does he choose to do this? Because, again, because of the family wealth, he could have chose to do almost anything else. He could have chose to actually come here to the States. But he actually did the hardest thing possible, which was to join this underground band of fighters who tried to, you know, upset France from within. And every time they would carry out any act of sabotage, they greatly increased the risk of their own death, right? But Robert chose to do that anyway. So again, it was a big question of why. Why did he do this?
Right. And it wasn't only the family you turned to, because this is where your journalistic expertise comes into question. We all know that family lore develops and things are kind of shoved aside, not mentioned over generations, and uncomfortable things. Did you find any of those sort of things? Because I know you checked with French military records, the records of the resistance, any sort of things that were uncomfortable or didn't match what had been previously known.
Yeah. So, first, Robert didn't say a whole lot about what actually happened to him during the war. His kids, even as adults, were trying to just piece snippets of it together. So as I began to get more knowledge, and I had over 300 plus military, his military file, which had over 300 plus pages in it, they were sometimes turning to me and saying, well, what exactly happened here? So it wasn't really this lore. They knew that their father had done something amazing, but what they didn't know was exactly what he had done. So there were occasions, again, where they would be like, well, do you know what happened exactly here? And I said, well, according to his military file, it was this or it was that. But I didn't just want to rely on that. I mean, I ended up spending 4 years researching this book in 5 different countries because I really wanted it to be as contextually accurate as it could be. And also, because of all that contextual accuracy, you end up hopefully creating a bit more drama in the narrative itself.
This is mentioned at the outset that you mentioned here too. This was a unique network that he joined, the SOE, this resistance network. What can you say about how it's inspired, how it inspired similar groups afterwards, all the way up to, well, the fictional character James Bond, but also our own CIA?
Yes, exactly. That's a great point. So Special Operations Executive worked sort of hand in hand with OSS, the Office of Strategic Services here in the States. And OSS later becomes the CIA. And the CIA tactics, especially during the Cold War, they began to mimic a lot of what SOE was doing. They would train resistance fighters in various countries and then parachute them back into their homelands, at which points they would try to, you know, overthrow governments that were not favorable to the U.S. There's a dark side to that, of course, because of sometimes when those coups were not successful, or when they were, the new governments were sometimes just as bad as the ones that had been usurped. But yes, SOE was very influential in showing that you could actually do this sort of large-scale sabotage and disrupt entire governments. The spiritual father for this was T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, during the First World War. But by the Second World War, SOE showed that you could actually overthrow an entire occupied continent with the help of these bands of irregular fighters.
Mm-hmm. Let me put Robert de la Rochefoucauld in front of you, just as an exercise, and he's living. What would you most want to know about him and his experience after researching his life, his magnificent resistance to Nazi Germany over the course of 4 years for you?
It's a great question, and it's one that, gosh, the reality, Ben, is that I have so many questions. I had so many questions for Robert, from the tedious, like, what was it like to have lived through that, to the more profound, you know, do you feel that, because he was a commando for 20 years after this. He actually went into French-occupied Vietnam after this. And then,
well, there's your sequel.
The war took a toll on him, and I'm not going to give it away exactly how, but by the end of the book, I had a chance to speak with his daughter, Constance, and she told me a couple of anecdotes that made me actually pretty sad, because there were some episodes that Robert basically carried with him for the rest of his life, and I would have liked to have talked about why exactly he kept all of that in.
Mm-hmm. Seems like a perfect story for a Hollywood movie. Will it become one?
Yes. So DreamWorks optioned it, and right now, the director who's attached to it is a guy named Cary Fukunaga, who did a movie a couple years ago called Beasts of No Nation, and he was the guy behind True Detective, the series, the HBO series, starring Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey. The producer is Michael Sugar, whose last major credit was Spotlight, the movie that won Best Picture a couple years ago at the Academy Awards.
Okay, and who is being angled for to be in the role of Robert?
What is the so he was in that movie Call Me by Your Name. It just came. It was up for an Oscar himself. Timothy Camelot. I'm sorry, I'm just blanking right now on his last name.
Timothy Camelot. Yeah.
Yes. So he's young. His father, I believe, is French, and right now the producer and Fukunaga, the director, have put the thing before him to see, well, is this a movie you would like to do?
Oh, wow. Looking forward to that coming out at some time in the future. We've run out of time. I want to thank you so much, Paul Kix, deputy editor at ESPN, the magazine, author of this fabulous new book, The Saboteur, the aristocrat who became France's most daring anti-Nazi commando. Thank you for stepping into our Ames studio and telling us about this, Paul. And I think it's suitable, if you agree, we'll go out with a little of La Marseillaise.
That's perfect. Thank you for having me on.
The national anthem of France. Thank you, Paul. Time to say goodbye. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. RiverToRiver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.